Accession number 12419, Reel 1.
Mr. Atkins, Reel 1. Whereabouts were you born, please?
I was born in Crewe, Cheshire.
Which year?
1922.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was a regular army officer, and after his retirement he worked as an engineer on the old LMS railway at Euston.
Did you go to school in Crewe?
No, my family moved down from Crewe when I was aged 4 years.
Where to?
To Wembley in Middlesex. I was brought up there and lived in Wembley until after the war when I got married. I went to school at John Lyons School at Harrow on the Hill, which is under the same board of governors as Harrow School. We were goes back to the Elizabethan times, we were the poor relations of Harrow School when it was founded. But it is now a more well-known school.
How old were you when you left school?
I was 16, in 1938.
Do you remember the Munich crisis and how that affected you?
Yes, vividly. It affected me like it did a lot of other people. It was certainly a severe warning that unfortunately war appeared to be inevitable.
Did you have a job by then?
Yes, I was working on the old LMS railway by then.
In what capacity?
As on the clerical side in one of their departments in Euston.
What were you doing when war was declared?
I was still working at Euston, and then we were evacuated out to Watford into a temporary office situation out there, which went on until after the war.
Did you hear Chamberlain's broadcast on the 3rd of September?
Yes, very well. Yes, I remember that vividly.
Can you tell me how you reacted?
With a certain amount of dumbness, really. Dumbness and also a relief in one way that things had come to a head.
What did you think of Chamberlain?
I've read. It's very difficult. I find it difficult to be very specific on him, really. And there's a line of thought that he was taken in by Hitler, and there's also a line of thought that he really played for time. I'm inclined to think the latter nowadays. I think he played for time.
How did you come? Were you in any of the bombing in the Blitz?
Yes, we were bombed. We had quite a bit of bombing where I lived in Sudbury, Wembley. In our own road, we had a landmine, and whilst the house wasn't severely damaged, it was damaged. Yes, we had we didn't have such a bad time as the people actually in the East End of London, but we had a fair amount of bombing.
Do you remember any other roads or buildings that were hit in your area?
It was mainly, there weren't any well-known buildings, it was mainly houses, really.
What was public morale like in Wembley?
On the whole, very good, very good, very good. It was very. I remember I was in the Home Guard at the time, on the Railway Home Guard, and we were on duties at Wembley Station. And I can remember one incident there where there was a very tragic railway accident, where a porter had taken a truck across the rails instead of going up over the bridge, as he should have done, and a train from the north was coming down the straight there, and he panicked and left the trolley, and this engine picked up the trolley on its buffers, or underneath its buffers, and it was all right until it hit the points at the end of the railway station, and threw the train over, and there were several people killed, and also at that time there was an air raid on as well, so that was quite a vivid experience.
Did you see the accident?
Yes, I was actually on the duty at the station at the time, and that was my first as a young. I suppose I was about 17 and a half, 18. I suppose that was my first experience of a wartime tragedy.
What was it called? The Wembley Local Defence Volunteers?
Yes, the Home Guard it was, yes. Yes, that's right.
But was the unit called the Wembley?
I think it was. These Home Guards were very often large organisations like railways and that type of thing. They organised their own Home Guard units under the direction of the War Office.
What other duties did you have with the Home Guard?
Well, that was all. It was just mainly guarding the signal boxes and communications.
Did you get much training with them?
Very basic training, some drill and small and rifle drill and this sort of thing. It was quite basic, really. There weren't the spare arms about, really, to issue all the Home Guard units. We did have rifles in the end.
What did you have before the rifle?
I think we had almost like sticks we learnt to drill with to start with, sort of broom handles and that type of thing. Yeah. But that was only for a short while.
On the Dad's Army programme, they make fun of the Home Guard.
They do.
As a useless organisation. Yeah.
Well, I think it was never put to the test, so we can't answer that, but I think at that time, and one has to try and recollect the atmosphere and public opinion at that time, I think it was an organisation which the more elderly men and the very young men who weren't yet in the forces were able to, in some way to appear to be making some war effort, really, whether it had been an adequate fighting force put to the test. I have some reservation.
Did you think that the Germans would come, would get across?
Yes, I did. I did. There were very, very strong rumours at that time that there had actually been a small landings, a sort of a probing situation. But I never had any proof of this at all. It was more rumour than anything.
Do you remember any of the personalities who were in the Wembley Home Guard?
Yes, there was a Major Ford. He was, I suppose, at that stage, in his 60s, and he'd been an officer in the one of the rifle brigades in the First World War, and he was our CO of our unit. A very pleasant man, quite a disciplinarian, but he had respect of everybody.
How long were you in the Home Guard for?
I was in the Home Guard from the formation in. It was formed, I recollect, around about June 40. It was called the LDV, I think, to start with, Local Defence Volunteers. And then I stayed in the Home Guard until I went into the RAF in September 41.
How did you come to be in the RAF?
I volunteered for aircrew duties, I think around my 18th birthday, which was May 41.
What was the attraction of the RAF for you, as opposed to the other services?
I had an attraction to flying. I remember as a schoolboy going to Sir Alan Cobham's air circuses and this type of thing. So it had a some attraction.
Was there any particular aversion to the army or navy?
Not really, because my father, as I said earlier, had been a regular army officer, and our family was quite service orientated. No, I just felt that I wanted to fly. My father was a bit disappointed, and actually thought I ought to have gone into the army, but he accepted it. He was called up by this time. He was back in the army.
Was it easy to get into the RAF?
They were looking for people who were keen and had good health and met their medical requirements. I don't think, asking for particularly academic standards. I think they judged applicants on their at their interview and their attitude.
What was your basic training like?
The basic training, I thought, was very good. Very good. It was, on the whole, was very well organised. I volunteered in, because you had to volunteer for air crew duties. As I say, I volunteered, I think, around about April, May of 41, and I finally got my papers to report in September 41 to the Air Crew Reception Centre at St John's Wood in London, by the zoo. And we were in the RAF had commandeered the luxury flats around there. We were billeted there, and we were marched down to the zoo for our meals. I jokingly say we had the food that the animals refused. It wasn't quite as bad as that. And we also used Lord's Cricket Ground for for lectures in the long room of the pavilion.
And I think you also did some training in Scarborough?
Yes, after initial reception centre, two or three weeks there, kitting out, I was posted up to Scarborough for initial training, what they call initial training wing, which was, by the time I was under training pilot. And we had PT drill lectures, and no flying instruction there. This was all groundwork. And there were UT pilots and UT navigators on the course, mixed. So it was a common old type of course.
How were you treated by those in charge? Were you bullied or treated fairly?
Oh, on the whole, we were treated fairly. I think there's a relatively few number of the regular junior NCOs were perhaps a little bit jealous of us. Without appearing pompous, I think we were better educated than they were. And one or two did show it. They were few in number.
How did you get on with learning to fly? Did it come easily?
It came a bit easier than I anticipated. From Scarborough, I was posted then to in January '42 to Hatfield, which was the RAF had a small unit there, but it was basically a civilian airfield, de Havilland's airfield there, and their factory. And as a side, they were, at that stage, they were in the prototype of the Mosquito. It was in its prototype stage at that time.
Did you see it?
Yes, around the factory, yes. Always a moment, I can remember the very strong smell of wood and gum, glue. I was at Hatfield there. It was elementary flying training school, which was really the object of the exercise there was to see if you had the aptitude for flying before sending you on to further instruction, and my instructor there was the padre of the station, a man who had a fair flow of language for a padre, I might tell you.
A few swear words.
Yes, but nevertheless a very good instructor, and I went solo there after 10 hours. And from there, I was only there about a month, I think, and from there we were posted up to Eaton Park in Manchester, which was a transit camp waiting for postings overseas for flying training under the Commonwealth scheme. So we had a few lectures and visits to cinemas. Generally, time did drag a bit there, even though we were there for a short time. It was very difficult to ensure that you were kept occupied, because they never knew when you were going to be posted, to be fair to them.
How keen were you to get into action?
Well, I suppose we were all keen. I think, yes, I can honestly say we were keen to get into action.
Was that for patriotic reasons or just to avoid boredom?
I think it was a bit of both, really. I think deep down we would never. Somebody asks us a blunt question, you know, are you terribly patriotic? I don't think the majority of people would have given an answer yes, but deep down we all thought that way. I don't have much doubt about that.
Did you go abroad?
Yes, I was posted from Manchester. I went up to Scotland, and I sailed for New York. It was a civilian boat, and everybody had duties to perform on the boat, and I was working in the bakery. And we had a little bit of action going over the Atlantic in the convoy. One of the boats was attacked and sunk. Fortunately, my particular boat was quite all right. And we landed in New York, which to me as a 19-year-old had never been out of England except for the odd day visit to the Channel ports. It was quite an experience, and the skyline of New York is a scene I'll never forget at that age particularly. And we suddenly were in a land of plenty. Steaks, no blackouts. It was a completely different world. And we were in Brooklyn, New York, for maybe in a week or 10 days, I can't recollect now. And we were entertained by the local American community. I remember going to see Joe Louis, the famous boxer fight, Abe Seaman, which I think lasted a matter of a few minutes. And we were very well looked after and entertained by the Americans. And from there...
What was the attitude of the Americans towards the war at that time? This is early 42.
Yes, that's right. Well, the Americans we were mixing with, they were very eager to hear how things were in Great Britain. As you know, America is a very mixed country. Whether we would have had the same sort of inquiry if we'd have been in the German American people, I don't know. I wouldn't think so. Also, perhaps even some of the Irish Americans were not terribly pro-British.
Did you come across that yourself?
No, I didn't.
Where was it that you did the training?
Well, from there we were sent down to a primary school at Albany in Georgia, which is about an hour's drive from Atlanta. It was Turner Airfield, which was, by this time, we were temporary members of the United States Air Corps. And we were, I was an LAC by this time in the RAF. And we were treated as officer cadets there. And it was a discipline which was different to the RAF discipline. It was much more on the honour system. You were placed on your honour to do various things, and if you were found out that you weren't complying with these instructions, the type of punishment you got was to stand in front of the American flag for an hour or two. To us, it was rather petty discipline, but we had to conform to it. We were under the American discipline. We were under American officers there. We got an occasional visit down from Washington from an RAF officer who used to come down to make sure that we were all right. But basically, we were under control of the Americans. They were civilian flying instructors there.
When you say petty discipline, you mean you felt you were being treated like children?
That's right. Yes, yes, yes.
Were you punished yourself?
Yes, I did have one or two occasions when I was late for lectures or something like that, and was given this type of punishment of almost standing in the corner like a schoolboy.
How would you have been treated in the RAF?
I think in the RAF we would have probably been. We'd probably had to report to the drill corporal, the drill sergeant, perhaps do some extra drill or something like that. Or put on fatigue of some sort.
This scheme that you were on, was called the Arnold scheme?
That's right, yes. And after General Arnold, the American Air Force general.
Is this Hap Arnold? Pardon? Is it called Hap Arnold?
I can't remember his first name, quite frankly. We just knew it as the Arnold scheme.
Did you notice that name?
Yes, yes, yes. Because there were other schemes which the RAF were involved with in America. I can't recollect the name of them now, but there were other schemes other than the Arnold scheme, but basically the same.
What did you think of the scheme?
I thought the flying training side of it and the lectures were very good, very high standard. Unfortunately, I went down was diagnosed as measles while I was there, and I had to go into hospital for a few days. And when I came out of hospital, the course I was on had advanced even in 10 days, and I couldn't catch up with the course. And due to the tremendous pressure on training at that stage, I could not be posted onto the course that was following me, or even wait for a suitable vacancy on another course. And I was very, very disappointed when I had to leave the course and was sent up to Canada at Trenton in Ontario. For remustering. At that time, in I think it was March, April time of 1942, Bomber Command in England were starting to get the four-engine bombers, and they were introducing a new man in the crew of bombers, and they're known as bomb aimers or air bombers, and they were very keen to get this off the ground, and there was tremendous pressure put on me, not just me but other people as well, to remuster as a bomb aimer, which I did. And after 2 or 3 weeks at Trenton, when we were on fatigues and things, I was posted to a gunnery and bombing school at Port Albert in Ontario. And I was there for a few weeks, and then I went to RAF Picton in Ontario. And those two places were basically intensive courses on bombing and air gunnery, and also navigation. And we did a lot of cross-country flying exercises. And I was awarded my flying brevet as an observer.
Flying what?
As an observer, the category.
Flying brevet?
A flying brevet. That's like a pilot has wings, the brevet is the other air crew, the half wing. And I think it was round about November of 42, I'd finished my course and passed out, and I was then promoted to sergeant and posted up to a Canadian Air Force base at Moncton in Nova Scotia. It was winter time, very cold, a lot of snow, and we had to wear earmuffs, and it was a chargeable offence if you didn't wear these earmuffs when you went out in case you caught frostbite. It was a transit camp where trained air crew were waiting posting back to the UK or the Middle East, and also there were RAF personnel and Fleet Air Arm personnel coming in from the UK for training, posting to training in Canada or America.
Did the Canadians seem to be much different from the Americans, especially with regard to the war?
Well, yes, the Canadians were very supportive of the war, my experience. And during my training in Canada, I spent many happy weekends with local Canadian families, which I still, even today, keep in touch with.
Did that include the French Canadians being supporting of the war?
I wasn't in Quebec, but I did come. We did have French Canadians with us. I must say, at that time, and looking at it in 1942, I didn't experience any of the difficulties which present day Canada has with the French problem.
What happened to you next?
Well, when I was in from Canada, and I was posted to England, and I was posted to an RAF station at Driffield in Yorkshire. This would be December 42. I remember being home on leave over Christmas that year. At Driffield, we were doing further advanced training, waiting to be posted for crewing up. During my stay there, I developed some sinus problems, and I was sent for tests at RAF Hospital at Grantham in Lincolnshire, and they put me on restricted flying. I wasn't to fly above 10,000 feet for about 2 months. As a result of that, I gained further experience and was virtually on the permanent staff temporarily at RAF Driffield. And after the 2 months, I had a further medical exam and was then passed fully fit for normal flying duties. And then I was posted to, I suppose by that time, about March 43, I was posted to